hearing the I Have a Dream speech excerpted into music brings tears to many of us. The music is beautiful, the words inspirational, and I think back and feel back to all of the times that I heard that speech, that piece of American history, that really foundational document of American history and consciousness. And I always heard it in the beginning in the cadence and in the voice of Dr. King, and it comes back again and again in the voice and cadence of Dr. King. But I don't know how many of you will kind of get this. When I hear a foreign language, I hear words differently in a foreign language, more literally with different nuances. And I remember shortly after Dr. King's assassination, when I was living and teaching in North Africa, in Tunisia, they did a memorial for Dr. King at my lycée. And all of these kids were brought together and faculty members brought together. And the I Have a Dream speech was read in French. And hearing it in a different way, in a different cadence, touched me in a different way. Looking at all of these kids who were not living in freedom themselves and who were bound by issues of race and racism and classism and colonialism, seeing how it affected them and seeing them also in tears and with questions, unanswerable questions, coming up to me afterwards as one of the Americans and saying, why? Why did this happen? Why is race such an issue with you people, meaning Americans? Now, they had their issues of tribe and of ethnicity and of color, but they actually really didn't get our issues of race. They looked at an American Peace Corps volunteer who was Greco-Italian and darker than I am, and they treated him badly because he was dark. And they looked at somebody whom we would call African-American with a light complexion and treated him as somebody who was white or light-skinned. They did tone, we do race, and they're equally crazy and arbitrary ways of keeping us apart from one another. And I'm going to get into that more towards the end of this message. It is very affecting to me when it talks about our dream and we will overcome, because it isn't about just them, whoever the them are at the time, being oppressed. It is when people are oppressed, we are all oppressed. When we hate people, we are prisoners of our own hatred. When we fear people, we are victims of our own fear. Maybe not equally, but deeply. The reason to end poverty, injustice, racism, classism, sexism is for everybody's soul and everybody's life. When we think, most of us, of Dr. King this weekend, when we gather together all over this country to celebrate his life and his legacy, most of us think about civil rights based on race, and that is an appropriate place to start in our review of his legacy, because that's where he started his mission, with the issues of segregation and of race. When we think of Dr. King, we think of the Montgomery bus boycott. We think of the letter from the Birmingham jail. We think of the March on Selma. We think of the martyrs, black and white, who gave their lives and sacrificed their bodies during what we call the civil rights era, as if the post-civil rights era meant that we were all done and we had arrived, which is not the case. But we think of Dr. King in that way. We also think of Dr. King in terms of civil disobedience And that is a great legacy and a great part of what success we have experienced. I am convinced that if the work for civil rights had been violent, that overwhelming force would have been used against violent protesters, because terrible force was used against peaceful protesters. And one of the rules of engagement going back from Thoreau to Gandhi, and I'm actually going to put Mao Zedong in here, is you don't fight battles you can't win when they have the power, the arms, the numbers, the hatred to overcome what you bring to the fight. So what civil disobedience did was to depend ultimately on the goodness, the decency, and the conscience of normal people who would at some point be disgusted with themselves in beating and turning hoses on and shooting innocent, peaceful protesters. Now, it doesn't work all the time. It's not working in Syria at the moment. But Gandhi depended ultimately on the decency of the British to say, why am I calling them savages when I'm killing unarmed people? There's something wrong with what I'm doing here. It depended on the decency ultimately of the American people, who thank God for television, words that I've never said before and probably won't say again, but thank God for television, brought us those bigots, those troops, those governors, those police chiefs who turned on fire hoses, who let loose their thugs with truncheons, who let loose the dogs. There was more done for integration by those dogs than by anything else, but it depended on peaceful non-cooperation. And it was a mighty moral strategy. It was foundational to the distance we have come. And there were people who were hit. I was beaten by the police in Southern California. I had a colleague who was beaten senseless and got brain damage, a Unitarian Universalist minister. And, of course, most know about the Unitarian Universalist minister from Washington, D.C. church who was murdered. It was brutal. And brave people of every faith brought witness together, black and white together. It was us together. It was also religion being brought to the streets and being witnessed across denominational lines. That one of the things that was remarkable was not simply, though it was, black and white together, arm in arm, but priest and rabbi and minister not walking into a bar, but walking into a riot together and witnessing together and singing together and hurting together and healing together. It was a great moment, and this country has not known a moment like it in some time. So we are right to begin with that tremendous journey of civil rights. And we have come a very long way towards fulfilling the dream. African American was elected twice president of the United States. And they counted most of the votes, and indeed, not only did he get the votes, but he got the oath of office. And as many of you know, he's going to have the oath of office. He'll be tied with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because he will have taken the oath four times. Once when Roberts blew it, and then on the make-do, and once today, and then tomorrow again at the public celebration. Obama has an exceptional record already. That was a step and an important one, but it's certainly not an end. We have come a great distance. Today we can, my favorite line from the civil rights movement was Dick Gregory's, where he said, we sat in at this lunch counter for 2 years waiting for them to integrate, and when they did, they didn't have what we wanted. But we can eat bad food together now. We can go to the same hotels, the same restaurants. We can marry each other. The miscegenation laws are a thing of the past. It's hard to imagine and hard for our children to imagine what the legal situation was, how we didn't simply have bigotries and fears and issues, but we had memorialized them into laws. And how, if there are still people with issues and bigotry and fears, which clearly there are, we have gotten rid of those laws, and that is a big step. But it's very easy to forget, and I had a terrible fear that Paul was going to do my entire sermon, that in 1965, Dr. King, not believing that civil rights had been achieved, didn't change his focus away from, but broadened his focus to include war and economic justice. He observed that in the Vietnam War, disproportionate numbers of people of color were being drafted, and even in greater disproportionality, they were being wounded and killed. He said, there's something wrong with here. There's something wrong here. There is this economic determinism, not wanting to label him a Marxist, it's my add-on, this economic determinism, which is when the economy is not doing well, poor people will be recruited. When a war is not doing well, those who can least defend themselves through endless deferments, like Newt Gingrich, and many of the chicken hawks on the far right who were able to be pro-war without actually having their skin in the game. Dr. King looked at all of this and said, this isn't right. This war isn't right. And he began to change his focus, expand his focus to include the war and how that war reflected the social structure and the inequality of opportunity in the social structure. He moved a campaign in 1965 to Chicago and expanded the entire idea of economic justice, because how do you have equality of opportunity if you do not have equality of opportunity to a decent education? How do you have equality of opportunity for a decent life if you are not paid a decent wage? Dr. King expanded his focus to include tenants' unions so that people were not paying rent to absentee landlords who let housing just deteriorate, but they had some rights to decent housing, to decent maintenance and upkeep, and then not have that upkeep done and be thrown out onto the streets. Tenants' unions was an important part of Dr. King's vision once he had moved this crusade to Chicago. Workers' unions, the idea that we should be paying people wages that allow them to live and to live decently, and to live in decent places, and places where, again, there are schools that will create equality of opportunity. No, we will never have equality of results. We have different gifts, different backgrounds, but there are huge things that we can all do to make a difference in society. And that was something that was so important to Dr. King towards the end of his life, because he was really talking about the freedom that this country would experience when black and white and every other color and ethnicity was able to achieve some stake in the American dream. And the American dream was an egalitarian dream, equality of opportunity to live, to worship. Now, of course, the irony is that we have many more freedoms now in terms of civil rights than we had before. The irony is Sundays. And we have two sacraments on Sundays, one integrated and one not. The sacrament that is not integrated is worship, where, as people pointed out, it's the most segregated hour in America. And that's not necessarily by hate, but it still often reflects opportunity of class, of education, and of where people are allowed to live. That's part of it. Our second sacrament is well integrated, and that's sports. And that's probably the more important sacrament to many, particularly as we approach the holy day of the Super Bowl in 2 weeks, the great American holiday where we take communion with guacamole. But we have integrated sports pretty nicely, not just in terms of players, but in terms of coaches, not yet in ownership, but in managers and coaches and in staff as well as players. People are able to be together and be enthusiastic for each other and hug and hold and celebrate without regard to race. It's maybe the only area that's a true meritocracy in our country, forgetting for a moment the major fraud issues of virtual girlfriends and blood doping. There still is in sports something that is a role model of a meritocracy. But we still have a very long way to go, because economic justice is not on the forefront of most people's brains or hearts. We may hear the words of "I have a dream," but the dream won't come true as long as we are manipulated to believe that there is a tiny pot of money and of benefits, and that it is up to the middle class feeling squeezed to fight the lower class over this diminishing pool of resources. It is a plot to keep us apart. It is a plot that is successful in keeping us apart. The middle class is scared of losing jobs, benefits, health insurance. The lower classes are kept out. The lowest of the low are not even recognized because we say, oh, well, they're illegals. They don't belong here anyway. And when we talk about economic justice for the people who plant our crops and harvest our crops and bring them to our tables and wash them and cook them and serve them and take the dishes away and cut our lawns and raise our children as our nannies, and we want to talk about living wages and benefits, even at hotel workers, the unions are being smashed. Today, both public and private unions are under attack. And this is part of the way that, as I talked about in North Africa, they used color to keep people apart while we used race. We are using class to keep ourselves apart, thinking we've got to fight those aliens. I love the term alien because it seems kind of Martian. We have to fight those aliens because they're taking those good jobs as agricultural workers and nannies and servers and cleaners. And really? This is adversarial? Why isn't that we do not see ourselves all on the same side here? Why is it that we can't see in aligning our interests middle down, as opposed to the fiction and the magical thinking at the lowest rungs and the lower middle that says, you know, I'm going to vote really conservatively because I know that someday I'm going to be a millionaire and those tax benefits, I'm going to need them. So you better not raise my taxes on millionaires because someday I'm going to be a millionaire. Let's get real. Let's get real and tear down those walls that society has built to keep us apart from one another. He used to say that in classical religion that the wages of sin are death. I say sinful wages are death to democracy and equality of opportunity. We are all in this together. It is not that the rich people are my enemies or the poor people are trying to rip food off of my table. We are in this together. And the great vision and the great dream of Dr. King will not come true just being repeated and just with my tears or your tears and with nostalgia, but engaging the full dream from civil rights to workers' rights to human rights. And I can't end without a word on guns. When we look at who dies in our country from violence, we get excited, as we should, when all of these young children are killed, and that strikes our hearts because as human beings, we have evolved in order to have feelings for our children. But the children on street corners, the children in gangs, the children in barrios and in ghettos, the children who are suffering from gun violence every day, guns do kill people. Guns do kill people. Just this week, you might have noticed, guns are killing people in Algeria and in Mali. And where did those guns come from? They came from Libya. And where did the guns in Libya come from? Well, we sold them to Muammar Gaddafi, and we gave them to the insurgents who overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, and our guns are killing us at home and abroad. Unless we are going to engage the full issues of race, of class, of violence, of how we make money from all that violence, from destroying and building, from giving out the contracts to blow up the bridge, to letting the contracts to build the new bridge. Unless we can get out of this cycle together, we will just turn the cycle again and again, and we will mourn the children who look like us. We will ignore the children out there who don't look like us, and we'll try to stay away from a dangerous world. But I think that the holistic message of Dr. King is, we are all in this together. We cannot run and hide from the pain in our own society. We cannot run and hide from the pain in the world. We cannot run and hide from the results of all of the guns and all of the violence that we build, that we sell, that we give, and that we celebrate. It's time for a fearless self-inventory of how we lead our economic lives, of if we're willing to commit to paying lettuce what it would cost to pick if we were paying a decent wage, if we were willing to pay a decent living wage for the people who serve us, who help us, if we understood that we were not fighting them for shrinking benefits, but we were in it together, demanding fairness, equality, being treated with human decency and respect. It is the least we can do for the least amongst us who are our sisters and our brothers. And how they fare in the world will make a difference on how we sleep at night, either in terms of fear or in terms of feeling good. Dr. King's life was complex, exemplary, human, flawed, human. He made a difference. And each and every one of us, each of us is called to make a difference, a good difference. A difference that comes out of examined values about what we value, and taking those examined values and not just speaking of them, but putting them in our lives, putting them in how we spend our time, how we spend our treasure, what we're willing to do to make this a better nation, a more peaceful nation, and an example to the world.